Okay. This morning I'm going to talk about the place of emotion in our lives. For those of you who've been practicing for a while, you know that when we talk about the self, we talk about it being made up of five aggregates. Contact. let's see. contact, felt sense, perception, emotional impulse or emotional intention, and thought action, consciousness. The fourth one is the one I'm going to talk about today, which is emotional impulse, emotional intention. And kind of a little bit about its relationship with the fifth one, which is our thoughts and our actions that are evoked by our emotions and that feed our emotions. So, emotion drives our lives. Our thoughts and our actions are affected by our emotions, and they affect our emotions. But emotion's the driver. So I heard, I don't know how many years ago this would have been, maybe 12, 13 years ago, this young senator came to Minneapolis named Barack Obama, 12, 13, 14 years ago. And my son encouraged me to go hear him speak. I don't know who the guy was, but I knew that in listening to him, I experienced the strength of his emotional drive, of his emotion, of his feeling that he really wanted to better the lives for disenfranchised, and that he was determined to do that, and he was angry about that, and he was angry about that it hadn't been done. And I was impressed. more impressed then, more impressed then. But quite impressed, Emotions shapes all of our lives, and it shapes our motivation to contribute. And the difference between those people who contribute a lot and don't isn't so much resources, whether they have resources or not. I had a friend who had lots of resources that Barack Obama didn't have, and he ended up doing nothing because he didn't have the emotional drive. He didn't have the emotional drive. So with strong emotion, we can do just about anything within limits, of course. Just about anything with strong emotion. But there's good emotion and there's bad emotion, right? And let's take our worst example in modern history, Adolf Hitler. He mesmerized people by tearing open his heart when he spoke. He tore open his heart. And there was a whole bunch of German citizens who felt put down and disenfranchised by World War I and the Treaty of Versailles, and they responded to his strong emotion, and look what happened. So the fourth aggregate, emotion, has two sides to it, as everything does, right? And in 1995, Daniel Goleman wrote the book on emotional intelligence. Anybody remember that? When he wrote it, nobody even knew the term. Now the term is almost become a cliche to talk about emotional intelligence. But he wrote that book in 1995, and he defined emotional intelligence as the ability to monitor one's own and other people's emotions, to discriminate between different emotions and label them appropriately, to be empathic, and to use emotional information to guide thinking and behavior. And then he said at some point in the book, I'm quoting him, pay more attention, monitor yourself. Are you distracted now? Are you paying full attention? Because it turns out the basis of emotional intelligence is this capacity to be aware of what we're doing and how we're doing and to make a mid-course correction. So when it comes to managing your distressing emotions, he says, you've got to know you're having them. Otherwise, they're going to hijack you before you know it. Anybody ever experienced that? What he didn't say in this book, at least as I remember it, I haven't read the book in a long time, was he didn't talk about Buddhist meditation. But as many of you also know, he was a Buddhist meditator, and later he wrote about Buddhist meditation. So, through our meditation practice, we can learn to be more aware of what we're doing. We can be more empathic beyond the little group that we identify with. And we can learn to make a mid-course correction. Our emotional habits solidify around the repetition of a given sequence. We know that. We know how when something sets us off, that our reaction is quite predictable. Quite predictable. And this creates a kind of a mental inertia. The stronger the habit becomes, the less able we are to break out of these ruts. And then we're imprisoned by them. We're imprisoned by our emotions and our emotional habits. So, in Buddhist meditation, we're opening ourselves up to the possibility of seeing some space, as I've talked about before, feeling some space between the emotion and the thought action, between the impulse and the response. So, for example, some of you may have walked in the room this morning. Well, let's just pretend. Let's pretend that it said Ted was talking out there or online. And so you walked in the room expecting Ted, and you got me. Well, you walked in the room respecting Ted. You came to hear Ted, right? And you saw me, and you had some, I don't know what you had, yuck or you know, I'm going to just breathe or something. You had a dissatisfying emotion. And if you're doing your zazen, you can rest in the gap between the emotion and having to get all revved up about it before the story takes over. And then may think that you needed to hear Ted, but you wait until the neediness passes. And you might say something to yourself that just doesn't feed the emotion in this negative way. Like, I might find something helpful from Tim. Who knows? Or something like that. And when you do that, you weaken the link. You weaken the link. Very simple. Very simple practice, isn't it? So a guy named Benjamin Libet, a neurosurgeon who's now dead, made a dramatic discovery that points to the power of breaking the chain and suggests why bare awareness in meditation can be such a powerful method of bringing intelligence to our emotional lives. Now I'm going to read something about him, about this work that he did. Because the brain has no nerve endings and feels no pain, and because neurosurgeons need to be sure they have not inadvertently strayed into the wrong area of the brain, patients do not get a full anesthesia during brain surgery, but remain awake and aware. Oh boy. This allows them to speak or move a part of the body to let the surgeon know that all is well. Taking advantage of this unusual opportunity, Dr. Libet did a simple experiment. He would ask patients during surgery to move their finger. He used an ingenious doc clock face that tracked time in thousands of a second, allowing the patients to note the time with extraordinary accuracy. This way, they could report the precise moment when they became aware of the urge to move the finger. Meanwhile, Dr. Libet was also monitoring the electrical activity in the part of the patient's brain that regulated movement of the finger. This let him see when the brain actually began activity that would culminate in the movement. In short, it let him separate the movement of intent to, it let him separate the moment of intent to move from the moment of awareness that of that intent from the moment of the actual action. All this allowed the remarkable discovery that the part of the brain that regulates movement began its activity a quarter of a second before people became aware of the intent to move the finger. In other words, the brain begins to activate an impulse prior to the dawning in our awareness of the intent to make that very action. Once the person is aware of the intent to move, Leibniz discovered there is another quarter second before the movement begins. This window is crucial. This window is crucial. This is really what Zazen is all about. It's the moment when we have the capacity to go along with the impulse or to reject it. In this quarter second, we can experience great freedom, great freedom. We have the chance to break the chain. And of course, the chain broken once doesn't mean it won't rehinge itself, but the chain broken once is the beginning of real freedom in our lives, in our psyches. So again, impulse is inherent in emotion, and anger translates as lashing out at others or lashing into myself, fear into withdrawal, hurt into tears, but we have the power not to act, to access that gap, to break the chain of habit. We have that. All have that capacity. We all have that ability. And there's an emotional charge which we can notice before it captures us, before it takes everything over and dictates how we're going to behave. So by resting our awareness so that we can direct a mindful precision to becoming aware of our impulse, of our intention, we can discover the stillness that's right here. So it's getting to be nice weather. I came back into the state just in time. Pretty soon we'll be doing walking meditation outside in the backyard. I hope we'll do it very soon because the weather's so nice. So we do walking meditation. We'll probably do it quite a bit during this retreat that I'm going to be leading, but do it in the mornings. We do walking meditation in the backyard. I love it. But I have an allergic nose. I don't know if anybody else has an allergic nose. Well, a couple of you do have allergic noses. And that, the pollen, this time of year, not so easy for me because of my allergic nose. There I am. I haven't done it yet, but we'll be going out in the backyard. Be doing our walking meditation, lifting my foot, moving it, putting it down, and then my nose starts to get itch, right? And I start to get aggravated. So there's the impulse to scratch, but I'm not going to do that. No, I'm a guiding teacher, right? I'm not going to do that. So I have two possibilities. Since I'm not going to scratch, I can either notice it, just notice it. And then let it be and let it go, and it will go. Or I can reprimand myself. I'm not going to do this. Or I can think about my favorite kind of food. You know, I can distract myself through my thinking. So we always have that chance to come back and either be with it or get our thinking revved up to stay away from it. So we have lots of opportunities to settle into this quarter second gap. To this quarter second gap, which of course is timeless. It's timeless. And of course, what I'm talking about has impact also in the social realm and in the political realm. Now my allergic nose is starting to get activated. in the social realm and the political realm. So we know how politics, how international, national, local politics, how driven they are by emotion, don't we? Big time, big time, big time. And sometimes negative, sometimes positive. Unfortunately, I think more often negative. More often negative. So I'm going to pick on George W. Bush now. Why not? Why not? I had to use someone for an example. I can't think of a better person to use. when his father was president, his father decided to stop the Iraq War. Anybody remember that? He said, "Enough is enough. We're going home. We're going home." We know that his son was not happy. We know that his son felt that his dad had kind of wimped out, and that he needed to. And his dad. We know, if we've read about his son was actually angry that the Iraqis had taken advantage of his dad. He had that anger. He was angry. So he still had that anger with him when he became president. He still had that anger. If you read much biographical material, you'll read about that. He had that anger with him. And then there was the terrorist attack, right? So he was angry again. Most of us were angry. He was angry again. And he generalized his anger from the terrorist attack and magnified it onto Saddam Hussein. And Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with the whole deal with the terrorist. Nothing. But he already had that anger. He was able to mobilize the country. Maybe not any of you guys, but most of the country. Through the magnification and the generalization of his anger. No gap. And when we think about the war against terror, it's mostly motivated by anger. It's mostly motivated by anger. Anger is not a bad thing. We want to survive. It's Darwinian. We've developed anger to survive. So it's a mechanism of survival. But then our collective anger becomes a source of national pride, whether we're Americans or Iraqis or Israelis or whomever. And then it coagulates, and we end up doing some pretty yucky things, like imprisoning people in Guantanamo for the rest of their lives, it seems like, without any justice or any trial, just because of our anger. So, we see this about ourselves, we see this about our culture, we see how it causes us to act stupidly, we all see that, how it causes us to destroy sometimes things and people we love, and how it can be addictive, how that we get in this cycle, we magnify it, we generalize it. Bouchot did this to me, so, you know, this guy next to him is... I'm going to be pissed at him too, and pissed at her too, and I'm never even going to come back here. You know, that's how we do it. That's how we do it, right? And anger is important information. It's telling us something. It's telling us who we are, and what pains us. What pains us in our heart, in our mind. Just as physical pain shows something in our body that needs attention, anger shows that we're thwarted, that we're frustrated. But also we have an opportunity in this quarter of a second to change and grow if we just are with it, if we just look directly at it, so we can become larger and more compassionate. not trying to dilute the emotion, just pausing again and again until the appropriate action seems apparent. So I have a friend named Charles, who was a psychiatrist in Washington, D.C. And I don't know if you know much about psychiatry, but mostly all psychiatrists do is push meds, mostly what they do. You see them for 12 minutes, they meds. And lots of psychiatrists don't like it any better than anybody else does, but that's the way it's set up. 12 minutes, meds, 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 meds. Nothing else. Nothing else. Very specialized, very focused. Well, my friend Charles, who was not my friend then, did this with poor people. He saw a lot of poor people, people with lots of mental health issues who were poor. And he had this really shattering experience of going outside in D.C. a couple of times and finding people who he'd given meds to who were bipolar or had schizophrenia or something, living on the grates. The grates in D.C., I guess I've never been to D.C., I guess they give warmth and so you can live there or something, I don't know. I don't think it will work in Minnesota. So, and he was angry, right? He was angry. But he every time he went through this, he saw his anger. He was a meditator. He paused. He breathed. He was with his anger. And then when he came to Minnesota, he said, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm not going to be this kind of psychiatrist. I'm going to actually go outside, go into the community. I'm actually even going to visit homeless camps. And I don't care if I don't make that much money. I'm going to do that. And so he was able to, through pausing, through sensing the gaps, where there's interconnectedness in those gaps, right? That's where empathy is, in those gaps. He was able to create some wonderful community mental health types of services here in Minnesota. So we can experience the gap and see the narrative and maintain the focus and the energy of the emotion without the negativity. We have that option. And Thich Nhat Hanh is a guy who talks about this and gives us some advice about how to do this. So I think we'll pause. We have a little time. And I'll lead you through a guided Thich Nhat Hanh meditation on being with anger. So if you guys would just maybe get in a meditative posture, not too stiff, and take a couple of deep breaths, then I'll take you through this 2-minute guided meditation. And this is a guided meditation with breathing in and breathing out. Contemplating self or other in anger, I breathe in. Seeing the suffering of self or other, I breathe out. Contemplating the damage done from anger, I breathe in. Seeing that anger burns and destroys happiness, I breathe out. Seeing anger's roots in the body, I breathe in. Seeing anger's roots in the mind, I breathe out. Seeing anger's roots in misperception and confusion, I breathe in. Forgiving myself and others for misperceptions, I breathe out. Seeing self or others suffer from anger, I breathe in. Feeling compassion for self or others suffering in anger, I breathe out. So that's the end of the exercise. So what Thich Nhat Hanh is doing is he's encouraging us to develop a narrative within the fifth aggregate, with the thought-action aggregate. that doesn't magnify or generalize the emotion, but encourages our bare awareness, our openness. And if we do that, there's a possibility that we actually experience some gratitude for each emotion, even the yucky ones, some gratitude. Our anger is Buddha waking us up to be more alive, to do what we really care about, to really engage in meditation, not just as a practice, but as our life, as our life. So strong emotion is like a flash of lightning. We can harness this energy. I can trust my emotion, whether good or bad. I don't have to be pushed around by my thoughts and feelings. And I can return to the gap, the openness, the spaciousness that's always present in that quarter second. So I think there are two major difficulties for those of us who are meditators in finding and working with that quarter second. The first is the trance of unworthiness. A lot of people, a lot of meditators, a lot of other people too. I know mostly meditators, so suffer from a trance of unworthiness. And that makes it this a more difficult process for us. I think there are two major ways in which this trance of unworthiness manifests itself. One is performance-based worthiness. Anybody know about performance-based worthiness? I just was with my grandkids, and my grandson, my older grandson, who's 9, I was really excited when I picked him up at school. He lives in France. He was really excited. He wanted me to see that they had a race in the morning, and he'd been 3rd out of 25. And I had to go. Yes, he demanded that I go look at the paper, which was actually in the French classroom. It was right up there on the board. He was 3. And I said, yeah. I said, wow, that's wonderful. But that's really, what about the people who are 24 and 25? That's really encouraging performance-based worthiness, isn't it? And my daughter and I both shook our heads, because my daughter's doing her best to just show him that he's good just because he is. He's cool, he's wonderful just because he is. And then he's picking up all this stuff about performance-based worthiness. He's always talking about it. Well, of course, I went through that too. But we're better than that, aren't we? We're better than that. The other thing we do is we cover up our fundamentally deficient feeling of unworthiness with shame. Rather than feel the rawness, it's too excruciating, we become immobilized in shame and just immobilized. So this trance of unworthiness. So in your meditation, you just have to see that it's just a trance. It's only a trance. It's not something innate condition. If you see it's a trance, you have the possibility just to see through it, as with all trances. I think the second difficulty in working with this quarter second, is lack of patience. I mean, a quarter second doesn't sound very long, does it? And it's pretty frustrating when your mind is goes on and on and on for the whole 30 minutes of zazen, and you don't even have an eighth of a second of quietness. So this takes a lot of patience. And we have to remind ourselves continually that through practice we can become emotionally intelligent. We all can. It's not like some IQ at birth. There's not EQ at birth. Luckily, we can decondition the habit of turning against ourselves or trying to promote ourselves. It's the same habit, the shadow side, the flip side of one habit or the other. Some are people who are really good at one part of it, others are really good at the other. It's the same thing. We can begin to experience these gaps patiently and realize that when the Buddha said, our fear is great, and when he said, but greater yet is the truth of our connectedness, that was what he was pointing out. That's what he was pointing out. Our sense of well-being in the world, in our lives, is related to connectedness completely. Completely. If we just feel connected to one person in a loving way, that connection pervades. It pervades. If we don't feel connected to one person in a loving way, we get disconnected. We feel part of something big, even in that tiny quarter-second gap. It includes the earth. It includes love. We feel at home. Feel at home. So, you've been doing your meditation for a week or a month or a year or 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. I've been doing mine for gazillion years. Gazillion years. And if you have patience, you'll tap into this. You'll tap into this. When in priest training that I've done here at Zen Center for years, priests are expected to be apprentices for at least a half dozen years. They're expected to do at least 12 full days of retreat a year. I mean, why do I do that? Because I'm an asshole? Maybe so. Because if they need to practice this, it takes patience. Sometimes a whole day or 2 days of a retreat, you'll just be revved up. So you need to practice it. You need to practice it. And of course, other people are always messing with our spiritual practice. You know, Seth, how people are messing with our spiritual practice, our spiritual progress, and our frustration affixes on them. It fixates on them. I thought I was coming to a nice calm setting, and look how he's behaving. Or she's behaving. I haven't met her, but I don't know if I want to. Sorry, I'm just, you know. God, I think I can just go home and sit by myself. It'll be much easier on everyone. That's our metal armor, our emotional armor that wants to withdraw. Wants to withdraw. Patience. So if my wife of 49 years, 50 years next year, 50 years, is on my case again, here's my chance to notice how I start to get pissed. Come back, just be with it, just settle into that quarter second. I'm pissed again, come back to it. Until it softens up, it opens up. So my younger grandson is only five, And I took him to the school every day, walked him to school in France, about 8 blocks. And he has to stop every 2 minutes and pull up his socks. This requires patience. Because we only get them out the door in so much time, and they, in France, they close the door. You know, not only do they put all the names of the kids up in order according to how well they do it, they're running, they close the door if they're not there in time. But he has to stop about, that's an average of twice a block. Maybe 16 times and pull up his socks. And I said to Erin, I said, "Well, Erin, what's the deal here, my daughter?" And she said, "Well, Dad, I bought him 12 different types of socks, and that's just what he has to do." Patience. Well, I'm a grandpa. I can do that as a grandpa. Can I do that with myself? Can I do that with my wife? Can you do that with yourself? Sure, you can do that with you. But what about your little 5-year-old in child? Your little 5-year-old in here who's so needy. Can you be patient with her? Can you be just patient with her? Can you come back to just breathing with her and experiencing that gap? That wonderful quarter-second gap. That's really what intimacy is, don't you think? I think so. So, I read this piece by Dr. Libet 4 or 5 years ago in a retreat that I gave here, during a retreat that I was guiding teacher for. And at the end of the retreat, in one-to-one, someone came up to me and said, "Gee, I was surprised that there's so much time in that quarter second before I react." And I thought, yay. So, that's about what I want to say. For this moment. And there's a little time, so maybe somebody have questions or comments or something. Anything, anybody. Yeah, hi.
Hi. Let's say you miss the gap.
Well, yeah, yeah.
Plan B.
Plan B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P. You're going to miss the gap lots of times. That's why meditation can be frustrating, because you don't think you're making progress. And you think you've made progress, and then something happens that is emotionally jarring, and then you're back to square one. So that's going to happen. But you can always come back to this contact right here, and the feeling that it's evoked, and then a new gap, a new quarter second between the feeling and the telling yourself a story about it, or you're yelling about it, or you're hitting someone, or you're hurting someone. And you miss it again, you can come back again. And that's why it really does take patience. It really does. But I can see by looking at you that you have that kind of patience.
I'm a high school teacher. You kind of have that patience.
Okay. All right. Okay. Yeah.
I think like medicine, law, and prayer, and various other practices, you know, we're always practicing, trying to get better.
Uh-huh.
It isn't the conclusion, really, that we practice in anything. It's the practice.
Uh-huh.
Meditation is the practice. But we've come a long ways. And I think there's a story about an ancient healer that was treating a patient who believed he was a cow.
A cow?
Yes.
Okay.
He was convinced he was a cow, and after struggling with this patient's belief, he finally decided, you know, to send the patient out to live with the cows.
Uh-huh.
And the patient returned, obviously, very upset now. concluded and told the doctor, you know, I don't think I'm a cow, but I think what you did was rather awful. Put me out to pasture. The doctor said, but wasn't it the cows who taught you you're not a cow?
Oh, very good. Very good. Thank you. Anything else this morning, anybody? Yeah, in the back.
Hi, so I came in late and I was really looking forward to the intro to the movie night. And so, like, I had the expectation what?
You came in late and you were looking forward to
the intro to the movie night.
Oh, you're upstairs, yeah.
Yeah, and so I was 5 minutes late and the sign was on and said it's full. So I didn't really realize my problem. I mean, actually, I did. I was, like, angry. It was just taken over,
Because
I was rushing into it. And so, but I get, like, the person, the welcomer person, explained to me that I could come in with this talk, but his presence and tone was very compassionate, and I felt that compassion. And immediately, like, I was able to, like, recenter. And I just think that, like, how another person can influence so quickly, like, our level of compassion ourselves, or self-acceptance, or just wanted to share that.
That's right. Could you guys hear her? Oh, they could. Do you want to say that more loudly, or would you like me to say
that? So, I was upset. The anger took over. I was late, and I was just in the feeling and the emotion. And the welcomer person was explaining to me I could come into this talk, and I got the sense that he was being very compassionate, like, and that just dissipated all of my anger and got me in a sense of presence and, like, being. Just how another person's compassion, like, can stimulate my self-acceptance and that oneness and that connection.
That's a wonderful example. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Anybody else? Yeah.
Here's the story.
Ashley.
When I was little, I was your grandson. I mean, I was the sock puller up our I would go to everybody's front door on the way to school. So my sister, who was an overachiever, just hated it. Hated it. She wanted to get there so she could do the extra credit math problem kind of thing. My grandfather, though, which was, you know, was the patient one. He was the one that would... very patient when walking to school, even if I didn't have everybody's front door.
Yes, that's right, isn't it? So many of us have had that experience. And that's why Zen teachers talk about trying to develop our own grandfatherly or grandmotherly mind, which really is patient, really is accepting. Yeah, that's a wonderful story. One final. Yeah.
How do you distinguish between the emotion? You talked about how you started out by talking about how Barack Obama had this emotion that drove him.
Yes. Yes, that's right.
And then you brought up the example of Hitler.
Yes.
Emotion drives people to try to do something.
Yes. Yes.
And how do you distinguish between, how do you know when your emotion is, whether you should be in the quarter second or whether you should be running with the emotion?
So she's asking a question. You guys couldn't hear her. She's asking the question, which is a good question. How do you, comparing Barack Obama's emotion, initial emotion, which seemed to be really what we would call bodhisattva-like, really, really wanting to help people. How do you know when it's that kind of an emotion versus the more negative, destructive kind of emotion? Is that what you're saying? Well, interesting. I think my answer is going to be through meditation. That is, if we see the gap, we know whether that emotion is, whether we're feeding through our thinking some kind of possessiveness, some kind of fear, some kind of, or whether it's really coming from interconnectedness and intimacy. And the more we experience these gaps, the more it does. So that's my answer. But it's just my answer, you know. You know, I don't know. Okay, thank you.